stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'll be continuing to talk about our unconscious and how it uses its bag of tricks to protect us, to keep us from doing things that we aren't ready to do, even if we don't yet know that. I'll also be airing an interview I did with Charlie Protzek, pianist and accompanist and singer's dream. So, hang on. Here comes the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. If this is the first time you're listening to the show, let me tell you that one of the things I do here is I talk a lot about why we human beings can't always do what we want to do when we want to do it, and that the information that you will hear me talking about all comes from my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And in addition to going through the book and explaining the concepts there and adding week by week more information about why we human beings get stuck, why we do things like signing up for gyms and then don't go, I'm also doing an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I'm interviewing people who make their living or their life with some art form. And in this show, as I hope for the next four shows, that is all the shows of this month, I'm going to be interviewing pianists. I have a real soft spot in my heart for people who play the piano and for the piano itself. I don't understand it exactly, but the sound of the piano when someone is playing it, especially when they're playing certain combinations of notes and chords, or they're playing in a particular style, God, I feel that in my body. I've never heard anybody else say that exactly, and it doesn't really happen to me with any other instrument, and I'm very fond of many other instruments, but the piano owns me in a way that other instruments don't. And so I've got, as I said, a real soft spot for anybody who can play it. I don't play very well. It's odd, isn't it? I can only play the songs that I write. And even then, I can only play in one style, which is why I need people to play. Oh, and I suppose I ought to mention that the song that opened the show and the song that's closing the show are both off my CD. They are songs that I wrote, but I am not playing them. The brilliant musicians who helped me with that CD are playing them. And if you are curious about them or it or the book or me, you can go up on my website, which is thelinshow.com. That's L-Y-N-N-E, thelinshow.com, and all that stuff is up there. In the last few shows, I've been talking about our unconscious, and I've been making the point that our unconscious stops us from doing things which we may think we want to do, which we may think we have to do, and it always has a really good reason. And I've been talking about what are some of the reasons that our unconscious stops us, that is, gets in the way of what we think we want to do, what our conscious mind thinks we want to do. Last time, I described what I label the civil war. That is a war between our conscious mind and our unconscious mind. Our conscious mind is saying, do it, or stop doing it, stop doing it. And our unconscious mind is throwing roadblocks and obstacles and making it impossible for us to listen to the commands of our conscious mind. At the end of the show, I challenged my listeners to catch themselves in a civil war, to hear themselves yelling at themselves about something that they were not able to do, criticizing, abusing, punishing, beating up. And so, as I suggested I would at the end of the last show, I'm asking, how'd you do? Did you catch yourself calling yourself names, giving yourself challenges which you're pretty sure you're not going to achieve, punishing yourself because you have failed in something you thought you needed to do? Well, I hope that you did catch yourself. I know that you did it because we all do it. And the extent to which you can catch yourself is the extent to which you're on your way to stopping. And you really do have to stop. Because all of that beating up, yelling at, punishing, abusing, challenging, all that stuff, that just lowers your self-esteem and it heightens your anxiety. And when you have lower self-esteem and heightened anxiety, everything is harder to do. So I want to, again, encourage you to be alert. If you can't interrupt your civil war, if you can't stop yourself from doing it, okay, at least recognize it and don't make it another opportunity to yell at yourself. Don't go, oh God, I did it again, stupid me, when am I going to stop? No, 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 no. No, it's good for me. I'm aware of it now. I'm on the road to stopping it. And of course, you have to believe me that stopping it will help and continuing to beat yourself up will hurt. Well, you see, the world can be a really harsh taskmaster, insisting on performance and judging failure really badly. And if, after a grueling day of dealing with an uncompromising world, you come home to another adversary, yourself, then there's no place to rest. When you're at war with yourself, the enemy is always there, armed and dangerous. You need and deserve a safe place to retreat, to recoup, to rejuvenate, and to prepare to meet the world's demands. But when you're engaged in a civil war, instead of the comfort, rest, soothing, and encouragement you desire and need and deserve, you receive scorn and derision and punishment. This can turn your life into an endless series of tests and challenges, competing, defending, explaining, and worrying. Instead of helping you reach your goal, the civil war disables you. The constant fighting drains you of precious energy. It leaves you less able to pursue the change you want to make or to enjoy the pleasure you might be having in the meanwhile. So, if you've been able to recognize that you are often, sometimes, all the time, fighting a futile civil war with yourself, even if you haven't been able to interrupt it yet, try and reward yourself. Take yourself to the movies, or pick up a novel, or go for a walk, or give yourself a reward. It's a very, very big deal. And I'm going to be talking more in future shows about why the criticism that we're so fond of in this culture doesn't work. But today I'm going to begin to describe some of the tricks that our unconscious uses to protect us. Some of those tricks that are in the bag of the unconscious and that it drags out to stop us from doing things that we shouldn't be doing. And those tricks are quite often the things that we yell at ourselves about. So see if you recognize any of these tricks. If you see that these are some of the things that your unconscious has been doing to protect you. And again, if you recognize them, congratulate yourself. It's terrific. Our unconscious is ingenious and clever. It has the most creative and surprising techniques to use on our behalf. Do you know the favorite way your unconscious has of communicating with you? For example, do you get sleepy when you don't want to do something? Are you always late to places you didn't really want to go? Do you get hunches or strong feelings or intuitions about things? Some of the things I'm going to talk about are the most common methods used by our unconscious to inform us of its intent. But this list is by no means exhaustive. Everybody's unconscious is unique, and each has its own person-specific ways of making its point. Some of these things may fit you. You may recognize them. They may be true for you, and some of them may not. It's just like dreams, which is one of the tricks in our unconscious's bag. Different dreams mean different things to different people. The unconscious will operate in your life in a way that makes sense for you. So, my own unconscious, for example, often speaks to me through music. I have a friend who calls this the internal DJ. I love that definition, and I think that it's perfect. So, my unconscious is often DJing for me. And as a result, I pay really close attention to the songs that I find myself humming, the tunes I just can't get out of my head. Many years ago, when I was interning to become a therapist, I was assigned a client who I didn't feel capable of treating. She had stuff I didn't understand. But my training suggested, and my conscious mind agreed, that I ought to be able to treat anybody who walked in the door. I know a lot better now, but I didn't know it then. So I kept going back and forth between, I'm too inexperienced to help this young woman, and you should be able to do this. I don't think I can. Oh, but you must. I was very, very torn, and I couldn't decide what to do until I heard myself humming the song, "Go Away, Little Girl." I promptly referred her to a more experienced therapist, acting on the message from my unconscious. So, as I describe the following tricks that I have seen in action, not only in myself, but in my clients and my friends and my family, see if any of the ones that I mention here sound familiar to you. If you're curious and open to self-exploration, and if you're listening to my show, you probably are, you may discover a whole world of information about yourself that you never even suspected. Okay, we're going to start with a perennial favorite, the well-known Freudian slip. So when the demands of your conscious and your unconscious mind are in direct opposition, you can be said to be of two minds. And those two minds often have very different agendas, so it's no wonder that you're confused. And as you can see from what I was saying about the Civil War, You can think you want to do something and then find yourself doing something else. When your actions run counter to your beliefs, you may be tempted to discount your actions. It's a cliche, but remember, actions really do speak louder than words. And the Freudian slip is a perfect example of the ability of your two minds to give you mixed messages. When you make a Freudian slip, you intend to say one thing, but you actually say another. Your unconscious mind is using your own words to tell you something about yourself. So this could be something you don't know about yourself, like the exposure of an undercover quality. It could be something you'd rather not know, like the recalling of a traumatic event. Or it could be something that you'd rather not admit. For example, a secret critic of Dr. Freud once introduced him as Dr. Fraud. If you have the courage to honor rather than discount the actions that contradict your beliefs, you may find that your unconscious has buried an important message in the action, in the slip. And here I'm going to tell you the story of a client of mine named Eva. Eva's mother was an alcoholic. She was not abusive, but she was not able to care for her children, really. And so Eva's older sister, Susan, was really her mother. In a therapy session, when Eva was talking about her sister, she would continually refer to her as her mother. Now, Eva consciously did not recall her mother's incapacity. She thought of her mother as her mother, and she wasn't really consciously aware of how little mothering she got from her, quote, mother. But whenever she talked about her sister, Susan, she would call her her mother. And occasionally, when she meant to say mother, she would say sister. She was terribly embarrassed about this. And no matter how many times I pointed it out to her, she could not make herself stop confusing the words. What was happening was that Eva was finally ready to face how incompetent, really, as a mother, her mother had been. And her unconscious kept giving her this information, whether her conscious mind liked it or not. Here are a couple of other Freudian slips made by people who didn't know they were making them. What do you think they indicate about the people who made them? Jack continued to sing, "Hurt my healing heart," when the lyric was actually, "Heal my hurting heart." And Alex congratulated Charles, who had just entered the seminary, on having entered the cemetery. Like Eve and Charles and Jack, you may discount the mixed messages that you receive from yourself. You too may try to ignore actions you don't understand or that embarrass you. But such actions can be useful sources of information, even when they seem to contradict one another. And as the poet Walt Whitman wrote in his epic poem, Song of Myself, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I contain multitudes." And so do you. So that's the first and probably the best known trick in our unconscious's bag. And I wonder if you are now alert, on the lookout for Freudian slips that you might make, and if you are more willing to take them seriously, even if they embarrass you. Next week, I will add another trick, maybe two if I have time. But right now, I'm going to play the interview that I did with pianist, accompanist Charlie Prodzik. And before that, I'm going to play some songs off of his CD. You are in for an amazing treat today if you love good music, and especially if you love jazz. Well, no, just if you love good music. Because today I am going to air an interview with Charlie Prodzik, who is a wonderful, wonderful piano player and the perfect accompanist for a singer, and also, as you will hear, a wonderful composer. This is one of the shortest interviews that I have ever done, and that's because Charlie doesn't communicate basically through words, language, talking. He communicates at that piano. And so I'm going to play the interview so that you can hear him and get a sense of him and what goes into making him. But I'm going to play several cuts from the CD he gave me, a CD called Dream World, which, according to this interview he did 5 years ago, he isn't young, and so it took him, like it took me, a long time to get around to doing the CD, and I certainly hope that he does another one, because this is just glorious. The first song I'm going to play from it is called Cantique. There are two originals on this CD, and Cantique is the first one. I'm going to play that, then I'm going to play another song, and then I'm going to play the interview. But here is the sensitive, beautiful... God, I can't think of words that really capture what happens when Charlie sits down at the piano, so I guess I'll just stop and play it. Thank you. Isn't that beautiful? I told you. And at the end of the show, I'm going to play another original tune of Charlie's, the title tune from the CD Dream World. And I've probably told you this before and will probably tell you this again, because I record these shows at different times and I sometimes forget what I said, but I don't want to forget to tell you that you can get in touch with Charlie at the following email address. That is charles941@verizon.net, in case you want to get this CD for yourselves. And I can't imagine that you won't want to. But having played that gorgeous piece, in the event that you think that because he can think and play so amazingly beautifully that he can't swing, I'm going to play the following cut from the same CD, Dream World, in which he not only swings, but he features the bass and drummers on the CD. That's Mark Nierenschwanger and Chuck Parr. And I'm happy to say that I'm going to be interviewing Mark soon. So here is They Say It's Wonderful. Thank you. you've heard what Charlie does naturally, easily, spectacularly, I'm going to play the interview I did with him, and I'm starting it just as we started. Charlie is shy and not really comfortable doing this interview, so you can hear. He starts out by saying to me, "What are we doing here, Charlie and me?"
What are we doing?
Okay, what we're doing is I am interviewing Charlie Pratzek, who is not happy about it, but is so generous that he's indulging me. We'll see. Charlie Pratzek is a brilliant piano player. He's a singer's dream. He is the person you always want to have at the piano when you are singing. And I know this because I have had the opportunity to sing with Charlie behind me many, many, many times. And he has saved me many, many, many times. When I have gotten lost, I can hear Charlie finding me on the piano, letting me know where I'm supposed to be. This is an incredibly rare capacity. So not only is he a brilliant piano player, but he's a kind and generous accompanist. So this is the thing, Charlie. I'm doing this radio show, and I can do whatever I want. So I've decided to do some interviews with people who make their living with their art, playing, dancing, painting, singing, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And mostly what I want is just to know whatever it is that you would feel comfortable saying about what it's like to have made a life, because you have. You've been playing. How many years are you playing?
Oh, I would say 45 or so.
Mm-hmm. Professionally,
yeah.
How long?
Professionally, yeah.
45 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That has to be, I mean, you have to be in a small percentage of people who've been able to play for 45 years.
That's probably true, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The smarter people would get a day job. But no, I have done that, and I've also worked two jobs, actually, with the music company. When I was in Dallas for 35 years,
mm-hmm.
and I worked for a music company there.
What did you do there?
Well, I did a little bit of everything. I was a salesman first in piano department stores there for them, and then I took over their warehouse and handled all their band instruments and things like that. And then when I would call on the schools, the band directors in the schools and all.
And place them or sell them or make sure they had them?
Yeah, right. Well, they had a rental program,
mm-hmm.
where they would rent on like a 3-month basis, you know. And I was a store manager for a while, about mm-hmm. 5 years. Yeah. But I was trying to play at the same time, you know. And
so, day and night.
Yeah. Sometimes you didn't know whether you were
coming or going.
And then if the child was not taking to it, they could return the instrument. Mm.
So was there a lot of work in Dallas when you were?
Yeah. Yeah, I went there in 1961, and a friend of mine I had gone to college with urged me to come down there, and I did. And there were a lot of clubs there that had trios, bass, piano, and drums. And they were all private clubs because they did not sell liquor by the drink down there across the bar. You know, you had to bring your own bottle.
That wow. Kind of.
So, but they all had trios. There was a lot of clubs like that. So I started working there and did most of my playing there, right there in Dallas. Did not travel or anything.
Oh my God, another anomaly.
Yes.
Truly, a musician who is playing in town?
Yeah.
Going home for dinner?
Going home for dinner. Of course, I was married, and I had 3 children, and I liked that. I liked being home.
Right.
I didn't want to travel, you know. So that's what I did for all those years.
But you wanted to play.
Yeah, I did want to play. And I have done that. And then in 1995, I moved to Florida and even did actually more playing here, because it was kind of drying up in Dallas at that time. And so since I've been in Florida, I've worked quite a bit and with some really good players here.
Yeah, it's amazing how many good players there are here in our little town.
Yeah, and some of the older people who had been around for years and were retiring here, you know, that had semi-names, too.
Yes.
So that's what I've been doing the last 12, 13, almost 13 years here now.
So
I'm playing with singers.
Well, yeah. Hmm. How did you get started? I mean, are you from a musical family?
No, not really. Nope. When I was about 9 years old, and I lived in New Jersey, in Trenton, outside of Trenton, and there was a guy up the street, probably maybe 20 years old or something, had a piano, and he played somewhat, you know, and I would go up there and listen to him a little bit. And I thought, oh, that'd be nice, you know, learn how to do that. So I started taking lessons. And the rest is history.
Well,
I took lessons all the way through college, you know, most of my college.
What did you study?
I studied music in college, yeah.
You did?
Yes.
So when you took lessons, were you learning classical stuff?
Yes, it was all serious.
All serious
study, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I learned the pop stuff, the pop tunes of the day, on my own. You know, my father would buy me sheet music all the time.
He would. So did they like it?
Book,
That you played?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Did they mind that you wanted to be a musician?
No, I don't think so. They never told
they never
me
said,
that.
Don't
at
do
least,
that.
No. I kind of decided that in high school. You know, I was really interested in playing baseball, which I had done quite a bit. And then I thought, well, here I am accompanying the Glee Club in high school. I better not be playing baseball at the same time, because sure enough, I'm going to get hit in the hand with a ball, and that's going to be it, you know, the night of the big concert or something. So, so I decided, yeah, I was going to pursue music. And,
do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one brother, yeah.
Was
younger,
he interested
younger.
In music?
No, not really. He took he played in the band in high school, I think. He played clarinet and saxophone a little bit, but that was about it. Yeah.
So you're just sort of
kind of a weirdo, yeah.
Well, in your family, I mean, you know,
in my family, yeah.
Yeah, because this is not an easy life.
No.
You know? And it seems to me from the interviews, I've been interviewing now for a while a lot of people, mm-hmm. and it almost seems as though the thing chooses them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's probably correct, you know. I don't know. When you're young like that, you don't really have a whole lot of direction either, you know. I mean, I think nowadays with the educational experiences that they have in school, they probably pick their direction a little earlier than maybe mm-hmm. somebody like myself, you know. But all I wanted to do when I got out of college was go play.
Yes.
I mean, that last semester in college, you know, I was cruising, you know.
Right.
Can't wait to get out, you know. And that's what I wanted to do. So I went down to Dallas, and it worked out down there. I started working a couple months later, you know.
Forgive me, I mean, maybe you won't think this is true, but you're a kind of serious guy. I mean, not that you're not funny, because you are funny, but but you're kind of a serious guy. And you don't come across as a kind of jazz musician type.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, people always said you look like a Philadelphia lawyer.
Yeah, know? Right.
Well, I've always viewed it as a serious thing. And I always wanted to be better. I always wanted to improve. And no matter what kind of a gig I would play, I did my best on it, you know. I never just blew it off or anything like that. You know?
No.
So, yeah, and I know I've improved a lot. I can see it myself over the years, you know. And right now I'm enjoying it. I put my own CD out about 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's great.
That was nice. I was able to do that. I just did it so I could have it to give to my grandkids. So I've done pretty much what I wanted to do with it.
The first time Charlie came here to play with me, I put a piece of paper on the piano, and it had 40 tunes on it, and it had keys next to it, and Charlie just played everything. I was standing here with my mouth open. That is not a common capacity.
Well, those tunes that you put in front of me are what they call the Great American Songbook.
Right.
You know. Now, I've been through that Great American Songbook
in every key
thousands of times, you know, And I've worked with a lot of singers, of course, and that's why I remember some of the lyrics occasionally, you know, because I actually associate the lyrics with the melody, you know, when it's going on. And if somebody sings the wrong lyric in there, I look up, you know, and say, hey, what's going on here? But, yeah, all those tunes I've played so many times that I know the tunes. And, of course, a good piano player should be able to play it in other keys also, you know, not just the key it was written in. And that's very helpful for singers. And I've done it with, I've done about, 10 CDs with different singers in this area, actually, since I've been here.
Wow. You know?
And, yeah, and so you just keep playing those tunes over and over again. And actually, it's nice to put it in another key occasionally. You don't get bored with it. You know?
Well, it was startling to me. And I agree with you that good piano players ought to be able to do that, so there may not be that many of them out there.
But there are some excellent piano players, young piano players that are coming up. I mean, I hear a new one every day on the public radio. So there are good musicians. Now, I don't know whether these guys are actually going to make a living at it or not.
Right.
You know? I mean, I couldn't believe it when I was in Dallas. I went up to North Texas State University and worked on my master's degree for a little while. I didn't ever finish it, but I worked on it. When I went up there, there were 1,400 music majors in that place.
Holy cow.
And I thought, wow, that's great, but what are all these people
going to
do? You know, well, at the time, actually, they were taking a lot of them to play in the big bands that were still going. Woody Herman's band, Stan Kenton's band and all, and they used those kids, you know. But those bands just almost disappeared. I mean, some of them have kept going, you know, but I think a lot of the musicians now probably realize they may need something other
to
than
fall back
that.
On.
Yeah, I mean, they can go out and play, hook up with a rock and roll group or something, and really hit it big. You know, I mean, that's possible. But I don't know. There's still a lot of talent out there, young talent out there.
And I wind up saying in almost every interview that we're not really a culture that has room for artists. You know, you know, a few people will make a living at it in terms of percentage of how many people would want to or have tried.
Right.
So did your kids play?
No, my kids did not play.
They had no interest?
No.
Oh.
But they are, my daughter got an art degree.
Oh.
She was interested in art.
Mm-hmm.
My son has a journalism degree.
Yeah.
You know, so they're all kind of creative.
So the creativity got out there, just not in that
right,
area.
Yeah, not in music, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I tried to give them piano lessons one time. That didn't work. You can't give your own kid piano lessons.
No, it's like a doctor operating.
I think they think that they don't have to practice because their father is the teacher. You know, he's not going to. Yeah, so anyhow. But they're all in some kind of creative thing.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would say, I guess, to people who fall in love with music or playing? Any kind of advice you would give?
Yeah, I mean, of course, do your best, you know, at what you put out there. And I'm sorry, but there's a lot of bad music out there. And a lot of bad performers, a lot of singers that really can't sing, you know. But it's all seem to be all visual now, you know. You got fireworks and you play loud and, you know, and you don't really have to have a voice and all that, you know. So I've never gotten into that. I've been lucky because I've been able to play all the standard tunes for years.
Mm-hmm. You
know? I never had to play any of the other things in order to make a living, except for maybe 3 years I did some, you know, Carole King things or Carpenter's
soft rock.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. But no, I just say do your best. You know, do your best at whatever you're working at. I don't know how long I'll be able to keep playing the American standards. You know, the people that remember them are getting pretty old.
Pretty old.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Although it always surprises me that famous performers who have made their careers in pop and rock always wind up doing an album with the American Songbook the minute that they can.
Yeah,
you know, Rod Stewart
way,
and Linda Ronstadt,
uh-huh.
and I mean, you know, they just
Carly Simon,
right? The minute that they have enough clout, they do the American Songbook.
That's true. I don't know.
They're wonderful songs.
They are. That's the thing. I think they discover that eventually. You know that they are wonderful. That's true. And who was the other one? Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. Right.
Folk
singer. And it's always startling to me. You suddenly hear, you know, rock stars singing, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, really, really standard, beautiful songs. So I wonder if they will ever really go out of fashion in a way.
Well, I hope not. I hope they stay around just like the classical music has.
Well, you know, it occurs to me that if people like that keep putting out albums like that, if their younger fans listen to that, then maybe it will kind of, you know, there'll be a next generation that will know this music because this generation of stars has recorded it.
And I think there are younger people that are interested in that kind of music, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have younger people come hear us play sometimes. You know.
Well, and also want to play it.
Yeah.
You know, I was in Pittsburgh, and I saw this young man, an amazing piano player and vocalist, and he's not doing anything that was written before 1952.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
I mean, so, and he can't be more than 22 years old.
Yeah.
So, those people are going to go on playing it, maybe people will go on listening to it.
Hopefully that'll happen, yes.
I am struck by your saying, you're talking about working hard. And being diligent and being committed to that. And I do think that's not that common, you know, that we are kind of a disposal society, you know, we're not focused particularly on hard work.
Right.
But, it, you know, it shows in everything that you do. And
well, working hard at it, you'll discover more things. You know, I mean, a lot of rock and roll people are accused of just knowing three chords on guitar. That's
right.
About it. Okay, if they do, if they'll study a little bit, they'll find out there are other chords on the guitar, and they sound pretty good, you know, and they come up with different ideas for music. I think that's what people need to do, you know, and not just stomp it, you know, stomp on one chord for 5 minutes or something.
No.
I can't really listen to much of that, you know.
I'm not always listening to exactly what's being played behind me, unless somebody's playing something wrong behind me and I can't,
okay,
I'm lost,
right.
You know.
Then you know it.
Right, then I pay attention. But I do listen to you, and it's a pleasure to hear you playing behind me.
Well, thank you.
You know, you are often just playing beautiful lines behind me, and I'm grateful.
Well, I try to accompany someone in that manner. Some piano players are a little too busy when they play behind the singer, or they're playing their own little solo while the singer's trying to sing the song, you know, but I try to just compliment the singer.
Yeah, well, you do, and even though you're not getting in the way, what you're playing is so lovely. So, I will take this opportunity to thank you for all the singers you have played behind.
You're welcome.
And for this.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Because I have completely run out of time, and I want you to hear Dream World, which is Charlie's original composition and the title of his CD, I'm simply going to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do, and tell you that I will be back again next week, same time, same station, 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, that I hope that you got something you can use or something you enjoyed or something that entertained you from this show, and that I hope that you will come back and be with me again next week. And here is Dream World. Thank you. Tune in again next week when I'll continue to reveal the tricks lurking in the bag of our unconscious, and I'll play an interview with another extraordinary pianist.
Sight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. Chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you